Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and joining me today is Michael Butterfield. How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm well.
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm so well, I'm happy. So, here we are, and we're going to talk about Zodiac.
Once again.
I've heard of him. I think he, isn't he like a, some sort of a disco diva?
No, I think you might have him confused with someone else. You know, I'd hope that you were paying attention during our previous calls, but I guess maybe, you know, you were taking a nap or something. But yeah, the Zodiac is well known, one of the most well-known serial killers in history. And this year is the 50th anniversary of the first Zodiac crimes.
Yeah, it just I get so many comments that he wasn't real, so I just...
Oh, I see. Yeah, it's easy to fall victim to that propaganda line that there was no Zodiac. That's seems to be a mildly popular conspiracy theory these days, but I don't, of course, subscribe to that.
Oh, you're no fun.
I think the Zodiac really existed, so that makes for a very different kind of conversation.
Well, that's just no good. So what happens for 50 years of a Zodiac? Like, do we have a party?
Well, I imagine that some people might feel that way. I know there's some people who are critical of people who show up at the anniversary events at the crime scenes and things like that. Of course, there's not much to celebrate. The case remains unsolved, and the families of the victims are still waiting for justice and some sense of what you might call closure. But the case remains unsolved 50 years later. We still have no idea who is responsible for these crimes. And we're looking at some efforts to use DNA to possibly solve the case. But without some news about that and some breakthrough, we're looking at another year of no answers.
So, I don't criticize people that want to go on anniversaries and do things. I just wonder... Haven't they got anything else better to do? That's all.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who are very critical of some of the people who show up at these events because they say that they're exploiting the deaths of these innocent victims. And while I guess it's easy to agree with that criticism in some ways, I think that people who do that, the people who go to those events, would tell you that in their hearts, they're there to honor the victims. They're trying to remember the victims on a day that is often spent celebrating in some ways the killer himself instead of remembering the people who died so that he could become a legend. So, you know, I agree with some of the criticisms about that. And certainly, you know, you would wonder if someone doesn't have something better to do than show up at a place where someone was murdered. But I think a lot of those people would argue that that's their way of trying to pay their respects.
Well, do you really think that it's paying tribute? I mean, I don't know, because I write books and I've done shows and I've been involved in it. So people will say that you know, to me, well, I don't read true crime books because, mm-hmm. you know, because it's, why would you want to read that? And it's,
that's weird.
Yeah. So I don't know. I really don't know what to say about that. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are some people who are obsessive and who this is sort of like a social click kind of thing. But I would try to see the best in some people. And I think that a lot of those people who do show up at those things, that's their way of trying to show that they still care about people who are largely forgotten in some ways. You know, when the 50th anniversary of anything comes around, there's obviously a lot of attention around it because it has a nice round number, you know, 50. When it's the 48th anniversary, there's not always as much interest. And often the things that you'll see in podcast, TV show, documentary, things like that, they focus on the killer a lot. And trying to remember the victims on these days is a way of trying to make sure they're not forgotten. And I know that there are a lot of people out there who care about these victims and you know, their friends and their family, people who actually knew them. And, you know, it's sort of like a little bit of like what you hear when there's a mass shooting and people say, you know, we're not going to talk about the killer. We're not going to mention his name because we don't want to glorify him or give him the attention that he wants. So I can see some aspect of that playing into these Zodiac anniversary things as well.
I noticed that it still gets a lot of attention, especially on a lot of the episodes we do, especially on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
More so than anything, it really sticks out. There's always sort of a negative thing about the Zodiac shows. A lot of people go on there and talk, and even the last one, you have a ton of comments like, "I wish they would talk about the real story."
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that means.
that depends on who's leaving the comment. For some people, the real story is what you were talking about earlier. It's this hoax idea that there was no Zodiac. So if you're talking about the Zodiac as if he existed and the case actually happened, then to them, that's not the real story. And then for other people, they might see something online or see a documentary on television that tells a version of the story that's more in line with some of the books and theories presented by various people accusing suspects. And those versions of the story are usually tailored to fit that particular theory. So you'll get a version of the Zodiac story that is true in some ways and distorted and fictionalized in others. So they might be saying, what I want to hear is the real story of what happened. And the anniversary of the second Zodiac attack is on July 4th this year. And that's one of the cases that's been buried in myth and rumor and speculation for years. And so someone might be asking, you know, hey, what's the real story behind the shooting at Blue Rock Springs and the murder of Darlene Farren? Because in that case, there's been a lot of confusion created by people who were either related to the victims and seemed to be looking for attention, or theorists who wrote books and presented various stories about Darlene Farren and her background in ways that made it seem as if she must have known the killer, or that she was killed in some conspiracy because she had witnessed a murder, or that she was part of a satanic cult. There's stories that someone was stalking her in the weeks and months before she died. So there's a lot of confusion around that case. And if someone wants to know what really happened, the best thing that you can do is go look at the police reports. Go look at the witness statements, the people like Michael Mugeau, who was there that night. Those are the kinds of things that are going to help you understand the real story. So I think maybe we could talk about what really happened that night according to the police reports, and then talk a little bit about how the myths have enveloped that story and why so many of them have been debunked.
So what is it particularly about that case, Darlene Farren, that makes people question so much? Like, what happened that confuses people?
Well, the story that we got from Michael Mugeau was that he and Darlene Farren was 22 years old. She was a waitress, a wife, and mother who lived in Vallejo with her husband, Dean Farren. They had just had a baby. And she was working at this restaurant in Vallejo where she was very popular, and she made a lot of friends, including men who were interested in her, possibly romantically. So she got a lot of attention, and one of those people that she had met was Michael Mugeau, who was a teenager with a twin brother who had apparently met Darlene at this restaurant, and they became friends and started spending some time together. And on the night of July 4th, 1969, Darlene got off work, took care of some things, and said that she was going to get some fireworks and she was going to meet her husband at home later after he got off work. And for some reason, she went to Michael Mugeau's home, picked him up. They were driving around together and decided to go to Blue Rock Springs Park in Vallejo, California. They were sitting in Darlene's Corvair talking when another vehicle pulled up. And then that vehicle drove away. And a few minutes later, what appeared to be the same vehicle returned. A man got out carrying a bright light. He approached the passenger side where Michael was sitting. And before Michael could say anything or do anything, the man pulled out a gun and opened fire and fired several shots into the car. And Michael was hit as he tried to jump into the back seat, and Darlene was wounded also. The man then turned to walk away, and apparently Michael Mugeau cried out in pain, and this caused the man to turn around, come back, and fire even more shots into the car. The man then got in his car and drove away. Some passing teenagers found Darlene and Mike, and then they went and called the police. And the ambulance arrived. Darlene was taken to the hospital, but she died on the way. Michael Mugeau survived, and he did his best to tell the police what happened and to describe the man who shot them. And he described this man as, I think, approximately 5'8", with light brown, curly hair. He seemed to make enough effort to fire into the car, but he didn't make enough effort to make sure they were dead. So one wondered what the motive was in the first place. And, of course, Michael's story was in the newspapers and everything. But shortly after the shooting, on the night of July 4th or into the early morning hours of July 5th, someone called Vallejo Police Department and claimed to be responsible for the shooting. The caller described the 9mm ammunition that was used, the location of the attack, and Darlene's car. And according to the dispatcher, Nancy Slover, the caller spoke in a taunting voice as he said bye. And police traced that phone to a phone... Police traced that call to a phone booth, but the man was already gone. Now, in this call, the caller also claimed that he was responsible for, he said, "I also killed those kids last Christmas, I believe." And that seemed to be a direct reference to the murders of two teenagers on Lake Herman Road on December 20th, 1968, about 7 months earlier. Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday were sitting in a car parked in this Lover's Lane area, and someone pulled up and they were shot and killed. So, of course, this created a lot of controversy in the police department about whether or not they were dealing with what would be called a serial killer. And, of course, shortly after that is when there were some more letters, some I should say, some letters that showed up. And these letters were sent to three Bay Area newspapers. They were virtually identical handwritten letters, which took credit for the shooting at Blue Rock Springs and the murders on Lake Herman Road and provided some details. And then the writer also provided a cipher, which he claimed would reveal his identity. And the newspapers published the cipher. The cipher was solved by a school teacher named Donald Harden and his wife, Betty. And they determined that the first lines of this cipher read, "I like killing people because it's so much fun." Unfortunately, the cipher did not reveal the identity of the killer. The last 18 characters appeared to be just gibberish. But this, of course, sparked more controversy because now the person who was claiming to be responsible for these crimes was writing to the newspapers and sending clues, and he also threatened to kill again if these ciphers were not published. So this created this fear and panic in the Bay Area, and a lot of people think that because the killer claimed responsibility for the shootings on Lake Herman Road as well, that this somehow distracted the police from investigating the background of Darlene Farran. Essentially, they're saying, well, as soon as they discovered that it was a serial killer, they stopped looking for anybody in Darlene's life who may have been responsible for her murder. So this led to a lot of skepticism about the investigation. And over the years, there were a lot of stories that started to swirl around the murder of Darlene Farran, things that seemed to indicate that there was more to the story than what we were told. Now, if you look at the original police reports, you'll see that in the three or so weeks in between when Darlene was murdered and when those first letters began arriving, the police actually did investigate Darlene's life. They talked to friends, her family, her coworkers, and other people she had known. And of course, the simple question was always asked, do you know of anybody who might have had any reason to hurt Darlene? And no one had, no one could remember anybody who was bothering Darlene except for one man, a man named George. And George was apparently a repeat customer at the restaurant where Darlene worked, and he was very persistent when he made advances toward her. She rejected those advances, and apparently this angered him. And according to one story, he even broke into her home at one time and threatened to rape her. Of course, these stories were not confirmed. We can't say for sure whether these things happened. But the police investigated George, and they eventually interviewed him. He provided an alibi, which was confirmed by his wife, for the time of the shooting at Blue Rock Springs Park. And police concluded that he was not involved in the murder. Now, maybe he was involved in the murder. Maybe his wife lied for him. We don't know. But at that time, police were satisfied that he had nothing to do with it, and they couldn't find any evidence to link him to the crime. So during those first few weeks, police did look for the killer among Darlene's circle of friends and family and acquaintances, but they couldn't find any evidence to indicate that she was killed by anyone other than a stranger. So in the ensuing years after this, when the case became bigger and bigger and bigger, because of course, you know, those first early cipher, that first cipher and those first letters were followed up by a subsequent letter, which was the first to use the phrase, "This is the Zodiac speaking." And that letter, of course, launched the Zodiac story as we know it today. And there were more letters, there were more crimes, and this dragged on through until what we believe were the last authenticated Zodiac letters in 1974. And of course, being an unsolved case, there was a lot of speculation and rumors and stories and gossip that went around for years. And one of the things that happened with the case of Darlene Farran was that some of the individuals in her family started telling stories which they did not tell police during the original investigation, but were certainly deserving of being reported because of the claims that were being made. And I've said this before, that Darlene Farren was in some ways the Laura Palmer of the Zodiac case. And that's a reference to the popular TV series Twin Peaks, which I'm sure you can remember has also been revived now. But that story centered around the murder of a young girl in a small town and the various scandals and conspiracies involving members of the community. So with the case of Darlene Farren, we have these stories that start to surface to make it seem as if there was something happening around Darlene which led to her death. And one of these stories surfaced, I believe, first in 1970 when a popular celebrity psychic showed up in the Bay Area and was communicating with members of Darlene's family. And apparently, I believe, Darlene's mother started claiming that on the night she was killed, Darlene said, "You're going to read about me in the newspapers tomorrow." And of course, there was no elaboration about this or about why she'd be in the newspapers. And then, of course, she was killed. And whatever it was that she was supposed to be in the newspaper for was apparently abandoned and surpassed by the fact that she had been killed. So we don't know what that was supposed to be about, but it is curious to note that nobody mentioned that to police who were actually investigating the murder. And of course, one of the representatives for this psychic held a press conference and criticized the Vallejo Police Department for not pursuing these stories, which of course would be very difficult considering no one ever told them about these stories. Now, of course, the police did investigate, and the continued investigation into the background of Darlene Farren failed to produce any suspects who seemed viable in her murder. And then, of course, her family at the same time, Darlene's family at the same time, was also giving police the indication that they believed that Darlene had been killed by her ex-husband. And of course, police investigated. They tracked down the ex-husband. They talked to him, and he was also given an alibi by his wife, his second wife, who said that she was with him at the time of the shooting at Blue Rock Springs Park. And police further investigated and concluded that this man was not involved in the Zodiac crimes and that he was not responsible for the murder of Darlene Farren. But years later, someone found a picture of Darlene Farren with her ex-husband. And this picture was circulated all over the internet as if this was some mystery which had to be solved. And this was called Mystery of the Unknown Man. Who is this man? You know, could he be the killer? Could he lead to the answers and help us find out who killed Darlene? And of course, there's never any mystery about it from the beginning. It was just Darlene's ex-husband. But for some reason, the confusion around this photograph increased, and over the years people believe that it's somehow a clue to helping solve this mystery, when in reality it appears to just be a photograph of her standing with her ex-husband. It has nothing to do with the case. But the stories about Darlene continued in the years that followed her death, until finally in the late 1970s there was a woman who claimed that she had once been a babysitter for Darlene, and that Darlene had at one time mentioned that she had seen this man kill someone and that now this man was following and stalking her. And this stalker story took on a life of its own after that, with other people, including Darlene's sisters, who started to tell other stories around this stalker, that apparently he was at this infamous painting party that happened at the home of Darlene Farren, where this mysterious stranger was there and Darlene was afraid of him and things like that. And the stories just kept getting bigger and bigger over the years until finally they appeared in a best-selling book written by cartoonist Robert Graysmith called Zodiac. That was published in 1986. So after the publication of the book, you had other people coming forward and telling stories about this painting party and claiming that they were either there or that some other suspect was there. And pretty soon you had this roster of individuals who were supposed to be at this party that was just amazing, various suspects and people who knew the victims and others. And the story itself, of course, had to be examined. And when I talked to Darlene's husband, Dean Farren, he made it clear to me that although there was some sort of minor party at his home where people were painting his home, although he said he did most of the paint job himself, he made it clear that the story that was told in this book and these other stories over the years, that that kind of party had not taken place in his home. And of course, some of these stories were also told by individuals who had some credibility problems, such as Darlene's sisters. Darlene's sister, Pam, claimed that Darlene had been stalked by some mysterious stranger, and then Darlene's sister, Linda, had also talked about somebody. And it turns out that in the mid-1970s, when babysitter came forward, some of the sisters identified a particular suspect as being the man that was stalking and bothering Darlene. And police investigated that suspect and could find no evidence linking him to the Zodiac crimes. But in the years that followed, Darlene's sisters, she had three sisters, and I think collectively between the three of them, they all identified at least six different people as all being the same single individual who had bothered Darlene. So you're talking about stories that just snowballed over the years. And one of the other aspects of this story with the painting party was that one of these suspects who was named as attending was the prime suspect, a convicted child molester named Arthur Lee Allen. And according to this story that was in this book, and then the story that was told by an informant who had identified Allen, Allen attended this painting party with his brother and sister-in-law. And I spoke to Allen's sister-in-law, and she stated that she had never attended such a party with or without suspect, and that the story wasn't true, and that the person telling the story was not telling the truth. So the way that these stories have focused on Darlene over the years, each story builds upon the last and makes this bigger and bigger and bigger conspiracy theory that becomes absurd when you start to realize that in order for these stories to be true, all of these factors have to coexist in the same reality at the same time. So I think that, you know, when you're asking me how did this get this way, I mean, we could talk about this for hours and hours and hours because there's so much material there. One of the other stories that has become a sort of virtual fact over the years is this claim that Darlene and Mike were chased by a vehicle to the crime scene, and that the man got out of the car, and shortly before he opened fire, he called out Darlene's nickname, D. This story was in the book Zodiac, and a lot of people believed it was true, and it was cited as fact over the years. And the story was attributed to a specific individual, and that was Darlene's sister, Pam. And Pam claimed that she got this information from Darlene's cousin, Sue Ayers. And that was all we knew about it for years. And a lot of us researching the Zodiac case tried to find Sue Ayers. And it wasn't until, I think, 2007.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast. Alongside my good friend, John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When I was attending the premiere of a documentary about the case called Hunting the Zodiac in San Francisco, I was one of the guest speakers, and I was talking about all these stories surrounding the life and death of Darlene Farren and how a lot of these stories simply were not true and were not supported by any known facts. And afterwards, I went outside to have a cigarette, and this woman walked up to me, and she thanked me for the things that I said, and she also noted that some of the people in Darlene's family lacked some credibility. And I said, oh, are you a member of Darlene's family? And she said, yes, I was her cousin, and my name is Sue. And at first I didn't put two and two together because she had given me her married name, but I quickly figured it out and said, you know, did you used to be called Sue Ayers? And she said, yes. And I asked her about this story, and she was very clear when she stated that this story was not true at all. That not only had she never been to the hospital, she had never talked to Michael, Michael had never told her this story, and that she had never told this story to Pam. So she couldn't figure out why Pam would attribute this story to her, although she did note that she believed Pam lacked credibility. And that's an issue that's come up over the years when Pam later appeared on things like the Sally Jesse Raphael show, if you remember that show from the 80s and 90s. She appeared on an episode of that show with Robert Graysmith and some others, and she made many wild claims, claiming that Darlene had witnessed a murder, that she had known some of the other victims. And then Pam was also in shows like, I believe, Hard Copy and A Current Affair, where she claimed that Darlene may have been involved in a satanic cult. And so you can see the progression of this over decades has built up to the point where there's this large barrier in between the truth and the average person who's interested in studying this case. You have to dig through mountains of nonsense and misinformation just to get down to these basic police reports, which show you that although it might be tempting to believe that Darlene Farren is somehow the key to solving this case, even if that is true, that is not what the evidence indicates.
You know, and I just wonder why her in particular. I guess it's just accessibility. And what about the all this satanic stuff now? And is that just a trend, and then everything could be satanic just because it's becoming popular again?
Well, everything old comes around again, right? when you ask why her, I think I should mention, you know, anytime there's an unsolved murder, especially in a smaller community, there's going to be a lot of gossip and a lot of speculation. But I think one of the things that may fuel this speculation is the notion that Darlene Farren had some sort of hidden, bizarre private life. And that's why I alluded to the character from Twin Peaks, Laura Palmer, because that was the basis for that whole series, was that there was this underbelly of corruption and everything to be discovered. When in reality, I think that mainly because Darlene, there are stories that Darlene was involved in extramarital relationships, and some of them are apparently based in some fact, while most of them cannot be confirmed, and a lot of them are just stories and rumors. But that's contributed to this notion that she had some sort of private life and that someone from that private life may have killed her for some reason we don't understand. You know, I've investigated a lot of these things on my own to the best of my ability, And, you know, one of the stories that's been used to promote the notion that Darlene was somehow involved in something sinister, which led to her death, was the idea that she had too much money. You know, that she had too much money for someone who worked as a waitress, and her husband worked as a cook at a restaurant. So they purchased a house. And, of course, the conspiracy theory was that they couldn't afford this house. And in order to put down the down payment and to make the payments on the house, they must have been getting extra income from somewhere. And this led to speculation that Darlene was selling drugs, and that that's where she was getting the extra money, and that she used this drug money to pay for the house. And then possibly she was out selling or buying or dealing drugs on the night she was killed, and it was a drug deal that went bad or whatever. So that's where a lot of these things start to come in, these gaps in people's knowledge where they try to fill it in with their speculation. The speculation about Darlene having this extra money apparently started among her circle of friends and others, and then it was in a newspaper article, and then in a television show, then in a book, and then it becomes a fact, and everybody believes it. When, you know, when I talked to Dean Farron, he explained to me that their parents had helped them pay for that down payment, that there was no extra money or anything like that. So that's where some of it comes from, but of course, obviously, that doesn't explain it all. I think it's largely because people are looking for an easy way to solve this case, and the easiest way to solve this case would be to link a victim to the killer, and for there to be some traditional motive, like jealousy or revenge, or someone was trying to silence Darlene, keep her from talking about whatever murder she had witnessed and all that. But I think also at the time that these stories were circulating, in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, that was the height of America's interest in anything involved with Satanism, right? I mean, there was the emergence of the Church of Satan with Anton LaVey and the Manson family and all these things, which just made people think that Satanism and cult murders were becoming a normal thing in society. And then, of course, you have the great satanic panic in the 1980s, which led to wrongful convictions and reputations being destroyed and accusations of mass child molestations by Satanists working in daycare centers and things. I mean, you remember all this. This was, for someone like me who was growing up as a teenager in the 80s, it was terrifying the way that it was portrayed in the media. And you had all these experts who claimed that, you know, they were working with the FBI and that there were ritual murders happening all across the country. And of course, this led to things like the McMartin preschool trial, where members of the McMartin family were wrongfully accused of molesting hundreds of children in a case that turned out to be a farce. And of course, this is also what led to the convictions of the West Memphis Three for the murders of three little boys, Damien Echols and others, who have since been released from prison, because I think a lot of people understood that the satanic panic played a large part in their conviction, the perception of them as murderers. So when you ask me, you know, why is this coming around again, I'm not sure why Satanism seems to become, why Satanism has become once again a popular bad guy. But I do know that, of course, you know, a lot of people understand that in the late 1970s, when there were serial killers popping up, there was always going to be some question about whether or not they were inspired by devil worship or things like that. And then later on, it was whether or not murderers were inspired by rock music, you know, like the Night Stalker. Richard Ramirez was supposedly inspired by AC/DC, and they were Satanists, you know, and people believe that the band Kiss, that the initials for the name of the band Kiss stood for Knights in Satan's Service. This was very, very predominant at that time. So in the late 1970s, when the Son of Sam showed up in New York, similar to the Zodiac in the sense that he shot couples in parked cars, and he also wrote some letters, and he also gave himself a nickname. There's a writer named Maury Terry, who started writing a series of newspaper articles for Gannett newspapers, I believe. And then later, he developed all of this information into a theory presented in the book about the case, which I'm drawing a blank about, the Ultimate Evil, The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry, where he claimed that the Son of Sam murders were linked to the Manson murders and to satanic cults all across America. And, of course, this theory was also included in the infamous television, I hate to use the word documentary, by Geraldo Rivera, who is now part of Fox News. But he had a show called Satan's Underground, where he went on and on about all these aspects of Satanism in American life and all these hidden corners of America where Satanists were stalking our children and leading children astray with rock and roll music and all kinds of things. And this was one of the most highly rated television documentaries of that time, even though it's an absolute farce if you watch it. It's just horrifying to see how this influenced Americans' opinions about all kinds of things, these false notions that Satanists were lurking everywhere. So it was only a matter of time before Geraldo Rivera hooked up with Maury Terry for the tabloid TV show Now It Can Be Told. In that show, Maury Terry, quote-unquote, investigated the murder of Darlene Farren and discovered the same old stories that had been lurking around for years and then used them to link Darlene to a satanic cult and possibly other murders. And, of course, the television show was syndicated and shown all over America, and more people believe that, even though none of this has any real basis in fact, and there's no credible evidence to support it. But that never stopped people like Geraldo Rivera, as you know, who was infamous for the whole Al Capone's vault thing and has basically had a long career of exploiting tragedy.
Well, you know, I don't know what to say about that. You know,
that's how a lot of people feel when you bring up Geraldo Rivera. So
yeah, and he was just kind of like the commercial. You know, he was just going for a lot of flash, and he couldn't He couldn't make it from intelligent conversation. He couldn't be a Donahue.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so he had to go for the flash. And
yeah, in the 90s, it was the height of his popularity. You know, when he had some racist or skinheads on his show, and one of them threw a chair at him and he broke his nose and, yeah. You know, became this big thing in afternoon television. And Now It Can Be Told was at the height of shows like A Current Affair and Hard Copy and things like that. And the Zodiac, you know, made the rounds on all those shows, but Now It Can Be Told did a two-part thing on Darlene Farren. And the first, you know, episode was pretty crazy, but the second episode is when they just took it to this absurd level and tried to, you know, they have these guys who look very earnest staring into the camera talking about how their investigation has led to evidence linking Darlene, you know, none of it's true. It's just tabloid TV, and that's what Geraldo Rivera specialized in at the time.
Yeah. Well, the internet's made tabloid the mainstream now.
Yeah.
It's more mainstream than what they call mainstream media. If you're on a network, it's not as mainstream as this stuff on the internet, all these so-called media outlets. So I don't know. I'm sort of lost in the mix. I just don't know why. Isn't it kind of victimizing the victim all over again?
Yeah, in some ways, you know, it's horrible when you look back at some of these stories about Darlene Farren, especially when you consider where they came from. Because for all intents and purposes, the evidence indicates that Darlene Farren, for whatever her failures, shortcomings, whatever, she was just an innocent person sitting in a car with a friend when for some reason someone shot her for no reason whatsoever. And that's bad enough for a family to lose someone they love, for a human being to be just exterminated like that for no reason whatsoever. But then for 50 years to have that story twisted until she becomes, people use the fact that she may have made mistakes in her life as some sort of reason to explain her death. And that's got to be terrible for people that knew her and loved her to sit there and watch somebody saying, you know, well, she was promiscuous, so she was killed by somebody that she was, you know, having an affair with, or that she was doing drugs or selling drugs, or that she was in a cult, when there's no evidence to support any of that. It would be just like saying, well, so-and-so's a child molester, without any evidence whatsoever. So the desire that some people have to find answers by re-victimizing Darlene Farren is really sad, and I've seen it go on for quite a long time. And you try to put the facts out there, but the facts are not as entertaining as this alternative fiction. And I think that's where a lot of this plays a part, especially when you start talking about how the internet and all these other things want to exploit the most sensational aspects of any story. So if you tell somebody, well, here's the Zodiac story in a nutshell, some stranger attacked a bunch of people he didn't know for some unknown reason and then disappeared and we don't know who he was, that's really not very satisfying. So it's much easier to cling to something that seems familiar, and people want to believe that the answer is somewhere there to be found and that it's going to be found in Darlene's life. And I feel bad for her husband, Dean, and I feel bad for her children and for her family and friends who've had to watch this over the years. And it is like she's being killed over and over again. And her name is being trashed and dragged through the mud, when in reality, through everything that I've read and everything that I've learned from talking to people who knew her, including her family and Dean Farren, she was a really nice person. She was fun. She was outgoing. She was friendly. She had a lot of friends. She was very popular at her work. And she was, I think Dean said, she was a free spirit. So the idea that she's been trashed in this way over the years is really depressing, because not only does she not deserve it, but there's no justification for it either.
Yeah, but isn't that sort of the way that things are being investigated now? Like, as far as all of the media outlets and podcasts, like you look at all the true crime podcasts and everything, and it goes from a conspiratorial point of view. So mm-hmm. anytime you're listening to these shows, if they comment on the story or the crime, they take the victims such as this, and it's something that they've done. Isn't it sort of the way we're doing it now? So if something comes out, you know, you see Jussie Smollett or whatever his name was, you know, faking a crime against himself. So even in that case where it was true, people look at the victims always now and have to investigate them. It must be something they did.
Well, yeah, it's victim shaming, victim blaming. And I think, too, it's easier for somebody to wrap their head around the idea that all these people who've been telling these stories must be telling the truth than it is to look at it like, no, it's more like a game of telephone, you know, where somebody told one story and then they got some attention for that, and then that story sort of got absorbed, and then other people see that and they react to it the same way. Some people, you know, there are people who have been involved in true crime stories, victims, investigators, who would give anything to get out of that story. And then for some inexplicable reason, there are other people who are just dying to get into it. And so one of the ways to do that is to make up a story. And in today's society, especially with the internet and the whole true crime entertainment complex now, it's a lot easier to get attention if you make up some sensational story. And some people might do it because they are aware of what they're doing, and other people it might just be some sort of thing that they're really not consciously trying to do, but they do out of some need for attention, and then it develops into something else, and before they know it, they're trapped in this lie they've been telling. But for whatever reason, it sure seems to be that two things. As you mentioned, victims are just under the microscope now. And also, people are very desperate for alternative explanations. You know, if you watch a show like Making a Murderer, where I'm sorry if I'm offending anybody who's listening right now, but I don't understand how people can even think that there's something wrong with that case. I mean, there might be some issues about how evidence was handled or some professionalism or conflicts of interest or things like that. But the notion that Stephen Avery has been framed by all these police and everything, I just don't buy into that. But that's much more entertaining than, you know, a 16 episode series about how this guy's guilty. So,
well, it comes down to personality, because they don't like, and I didn't either, and I've interviewed him, like Ken Kratz, with the prosecutor in that case.
Yeah.
He's a complete asshole, and yeah. He's completely, he's got an ego, and, you know, he's a guy on drugs, and he's, texting all of the people he's prosecuting, yeah, saying, hey, give me a hand job and I'll let you go.
He had that scandal that he, yeah.
Yeah, and so that makes him an ugly character, so therefore, everything he does is wrong. And that's what I mean. Like, if you're online and you say something, you know, let's say a Democrat, and you say something bad against Trump, or if you're a Trump supporter, you say something bad against Hillary, it becomes, it's not the reaction to what you say, it's the reaction to the character. So the reaction will be, oh yeah, well, you're just this, or you don't do that. You know, it becomes an attack to its character. So I think it's the same sort of, this is a natural reaction in today's society. So
yeah.
It has to be, oh, she was this, or she did that. She's got to be a Satanist, or she's got to be a whore. You know, it becomes all this convoluted stuff. It can't just be straightforward. Wrong place, wrong time, girl gets killed.
Yeah, and also there's a need that people have to believe that they can somehow crack the case, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a level of that's a thing that's become a major component of true crime entertainment now, is that everybody's a detective and everybody's trying to solve these cases and stuff. And that can only happen, of course, if you believe that the original investigation somehow overlooks something. So, you know, when it's, if it's Making a Murderer, you believe the cops set him up or whatever, which I don't have trouble believing that police officers could fabricate evidence or whatever. But in this case, to believe that, you have to believe all these other things. And you have to also have to reject the evidence in the original investigation. And the same thing happens with Zodiac. You see, there's the movie Zodiac that came out in 2007. Took some of these stories about Darlene Farren to another level. And because those stories were presented in a big budget movie, they're given even more credence. People think it must be true. So, you know, in that movie, you have Darlene picking up Mike and they're driving around, and then they go to the park and they're sitting there and a car drives up. And I'm trying to remember, I haven't seen the movie in a while, but I'm trying to remember. He says something like, I saw that car at Mr. Ed's, which is another place they had been by earlier. And it gives the viewer the false impression that Michael Mageau said that a similar car had followed them from this other location, which, of course, is not what he told the police in the beginning. And he also, when the killer is walking up to the side of the car, he looks directly up the killer and says something like, man, you really creeped us out. And then the man opens fire. In reality, there was a bright light being shined in Mageau's face, and he himself told police that he did not get a good look at the killer, and he didn't say anything to him. And so, you know, years later, I interviewed Ed Russ, the guy who interviewed Michael Mageau in the hospital. And, you know, he said, well, yeah, he told me that he never got a good look at the guy, and I didn't believe that he could identify the person that day. But then 20 years later, Michael Mageau was shown a photograph of suspects, and one of them was the prime suspect, Arthur Lee Allen. And according to police, Mageau pointed to Allen's picture and said, that's him, that's the man who shot me. And they said, well, how sure are you on a scale of 1 to 10? And he said, well, it's an 8. And then this story was put around all over the internet that Michael Mageau had identified Arthur Lee Allen. And Arthur Lee Allen's parents owned a home that wasn't very far from the place where Darlene worked. And then an informant who had originally accused Allen claimed that he had that Allen had been at this painting party, and I discussed that a little bit earlier. And then he also claimed that Arthur Lee Allen had taken him to the restaurant and pointed out a waitress to him, which by implication was apparently Darlene, and, you know, somehow pointed her out like, this is somebody I know or I like or whatever. And these stories just become bigger and bigger over time. And it wasn't until, you know, I pestered the Vallejo Police Department to get more information about this. And they finally told me, Joanne West, who was a captain, told me, well, here's the rest of the story. The rest of the story is that when Mijot showed me these photographs and he said, that's him, that's who shot me, he also pointed to the photograph of another individual in that photo lineup and said that the killer had a face like that person. Now, I've joked that that's basically saying that Arthur Lee Allen committed the crime while he was wearing someone else's face, but that's essentially what that story was, is that someone who was claiming that Michael Mijot had positively identified this person, there was a lot more to the story than that. So there are instances where there's more to the story than what you're being told, but this doesn't involve believing that police are involved in conspiracies or that the victims are somehow to blame or their decisions led to their deaths and things like that. There's just sometimes real practical stories there that need to be unearthed. But more often than not, even though I've had some success interviewing people and getting information that was previously unknown, more often than not, some person who's sitting at home listening to a podcast or something and then getting on the internet is not really going to contribute anything substantial to the study of that case. But that's where true crime entertainment is right now, is this, you can be a part of the story, you can be a detective, help me solve a murder kind of thing. And while there have been some amateur sleuths who have been helpful in unsolved cases over the years, that's not the norm.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you said it. And that's another episode of The House of Mystery. And thank you for being here, Michael Butterfield.
Thanks for having me, Al.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.